right, everybody, welcome back into Mining Stock Daily. It's a very busy day this Wednesday, and happy to welcome in an old friend of ours from MJG Capital, Mr. Matt Geiger over in the San Francisco Bay Area. Matt, good morning to you.
Trevor, it's good to be back on the program. It's been a little while. Glad to hear you're doing well.
Oh, well, you too. I mean, you have been running around globetrotting most of this late winter, so it's nice to finally catch you back on the ground in your home office. And you know, there's just a number of things we need to catch up on, especially I can't remember the last time you were on the podcast, but listen, I mean, this equity market, specifically in commodities, it appears perhaps has made a turn. I don't know if you call this a great rotation away from high flying equities and the big boards into commodities, but you know, there is concerns of escalating inflation, and obviously we're seeing that in commodities prices. And there's some macro discussion we can have on the back of that if you'd like. But really, I guess the general theme here is, Matt, like, have we made the turn here in precious metals and maybe even base metals commodity equities?
I'm increasingly confident that we have. I mean, I'm looking at the gold price currently, and for whatever reason, gold seems to be the bellwether for commodities more generally. It's not a rule written into the laws of the universe, but more often than not, when you see a major commodity move, gold is first out of the gates. And we can just look back to 2020 after the COVID crash as the most recent example of that. So I think key things that more short-term oriented traders are looking at would be gold closing above 2100. As we near the end of March and near the end of Q1 here, that's looking very likely unless we have a catastrophic day tomorrow. It's looking more likely we could see a close above 2200. So I think that would be further confirmation that this breakout actually is the real deal and not a fourth head fake, because we have seen three head fakes at this level in the past few years. Another thing to look at for further confirmation would be silver breaking above 26, which is pretty hefty resistance and has been for some time. So that's maybe one other data point. But yeah, I was very skeptical when this move occurred during PDAC. But 4 weeks later, it's looking more and more compelling. And if this is the real deal, I would argue this is very bullish for a junior sector that is bombed out, both in price action and in sentiment. We haven't seen much of a move yet in the juniors, despite precious metal strength. And we may need to wait another 4 to 8 weeks. But again, if this move is real, I think we could be on the cusp of a memorable move here.
Yeah, but I mean, that 4 to 8 weeks, that pushes into that old seasonality debate here, though, where it's that sell in May and go away and go enjoy your summer here. I mean, do we need to be watching this? Because it was the summer of 2020 where gold made a huge run up and the equities mm-hmm. followed suit. So that wasn't the case. But
2016, though, look back to 2016 as well. Precious metals and the equities did rally throughout the summer and into the fall. So I think if this is real, they would buck the trend in this instance as well.
All right. But talk about the setup for junior equities. You mentioned it's all bombed out. Rising gold price has not necessarily moved all of the equities. In fact, the market has decided who wins and who hasn't the last couple years. But where do those opportunities lie here? Are you looking back at old positions that you once owned that considering to take another foundational step into some of those plays once again?
Mm. Well, yeah, on the MJG front, we've actually just come off of a very active period. So stepping back to 2023, we actually went a full 8 months without adding a new name to the portfolio, which was pretty difficult. So we sat on our hands between February and early October of 2023. And the thought process there is that I was expecting the juniors to suffer in 2023, but not with the broader markets continuing to march on. My concern was that we were going to see the broader markets roll over and that reflect poorly on the juniors. And so we built up a 13% cash position at its peak in late September, early October. But we got to this inflection point where the broader markets remained buoyant, and yet juniors were at extremely depressed levels, both price-wise and sentiment-wise. And so I made the pretty uncomfortable decision at that point to get aggressive. So we did do 4 placements between mid-October and mid-January. Two of these were in private companies. Two of them were in public companies. Two of them gold focused, two of them copper focused. And as of now, we are fully deployed. So we'll see how that pans out. You know, I'm not expecting to add any new names into the portfolio absent any unexpected changes, or inflows until June, likely at the soonest. So we're pretty set with our existing names. I will say, interestingly, we're now up to 33%, copper weighting within the portfolio. That wasn't necessarily a bold macro bet, you know, expecting copper to fly in the next 3 months. Of course, it'd be great if it did. But more of a, assortment of opportunities that happen to be copper focused, where I like the people involved. I like the asset. I like the upcoming catalysts. I like the company structure. But clearly I'm, you know, comfortable owning copper focused names, but we're not going out there and buying everything with copper in the name. It has to be the right people, the right asset, and the right setup.
Well, let's focus on copper here then. I mean, what does pass that threshold? What are those key bullet points that need to be checked for MJG to even consider writing those checks?
I feel like a broken record here, but our investment process starts and ends with the people involved. Are they honest? Are they well incentivized? Are they fully focused on the task at hand? Do they have prior experience creating value in what they're trying to do with the current venture? So I really start with the people. And if it doesn't pass that criteria, then it's on to the next opportunity. Then we look at the asset. And I like projects that, even if they're earlier stage, seem that if all goes to plan, can work at spot metal prices, you know, at $4 copper. We're not big optionality investors. I'm not looking for those low grade, large, you know, pound in the ground stories that will never be built at $4 copper, but, you know, maybe could at $7 or $8 copper. That's a specific style of investing that could do quite well for investors. That's just not how we do it here. And then I look at the company's price relative to what I think fair value is, or at least expected value for the given opportunity, upcoming catalysts, and also very importantly, the company's working capital position. Do they have enough cash on hand to keep the lights on and accomplish at least one major catalyst or unanswered question before they have to raise next? You know, preferably there's a couple different unanswered questions that they can answer. But even if it checks all the boxes and I really like the opportunity, if I get the sense that they're going to raise in the next 6 months and there's not an impactful drill program or a crucial permit that we're waiting for, it makes sense to just wait, sit on one's hands and wait for the next placement and then reevaluate at that juncture. So that's generally how I go about it. At the very end of the process, I look at the jurisdiction as well. How does it fit within our existing portfolio construction? And do we have too many eggs in one's basket? And then I also consider the commodity at the very end of the process as well, through a similar lens. How does it fit within our current portfolio construction?
You know, how much were you paying attention to really the copper market itself? I mean, obviously, and we've had discussions. I was pretty skeptical in the copper market throughout the latter part of 2023. I'm maybe starting to come back around to it now here, because that it seems like China's coming back into the market as a serious consumer of the metal once again, as it continues to try to stimulate that economy. But we are seeing, I mean, honestly, all signs economic growth in the West as well. And so I'm coming around to the bullish case for copper, and obviously the chart represents that. But you know, how closely were you paying attention to, you know, the movement of the copper market itself while making these decisions?
To my point, not a huge amount, but obviously from a longer term perspective, I'm quite constructive on copper, but I really do try to think in 3 or 5 year time horizons, and you're not going to be able to get me to pin a price target six months from now. But look, I mean, copper has quite a few things going for it. The first is that the spot price is well below incentive pricing. So we're going to realistically need to see $5.50 copper, $6 copper, for some of these bigger projects to actually work on paper. You know, these are 40 to 50% above the current spot price. And if you listen to Brian Dalton from Altius Minerals, a seasoned, very wise and astute allocator of capital, he makes the point that in previous commodity cycles, sometimes you'll need to see up to 2x the incentive price for the big boys to really get a move on and press the red button and push these forwards as quickly as possible. So I think Copper does have quite a bit of room to run from that perspective. And then you also have to take into account these mines take a really, really long time to bring online. This is not a simple medium size, heap leach gold operation. To actually bring online a copper project that can make a dent in global supply, we're talking 3, 4, 5 years of waiting and $5 to $10 billion of capital in order to get there with significant execution risk along the way. Joe Mazumdar put out some good data in one of his recent Exploration Insight letters where he shared that if you look at the lithium projects that have come online in the past, say, 10 or 15 years, it's been a 4 to 7 year wait from discovery to first production. Whereas if you look at the copper operations that have come online, that time frame is 17 years. So these things take time and the price can run quite a bit without there being a quick supply reaction. So that also gets me excited. And then very quickly, there's a huge amount of potential acquirers. That's how you crystallize value in the vast majority of cases within this junior market that we play in. And if you look at the large gold producers, you look at the major diversifieds, you look at sovereign wealth funds, you look at the major copper producers, the Techs, the Lundin Minings, the Freeports of the world, they're all hungry for more copper assets, and they're saying so very clearly. So I think for juniors that get their hands on a late stage exploration or development stage project of merit in the next 3 to 5 years, there's plenty of suitors to take them out. So that gets me excited as well.
Changing directions here in the conversation, Matt, you just returned from a trip, let's just say, around the Horn of Africa there. But this area of the world has always been prospective for exploration and mining. There's been a number of opportunities out there, anywhere from, Somalia up through, into Egypt. Obviously, underexplored, lots of opportunities. The big, big companies are looking here. Even the small explorers continue to try to pick up land. We've seen positive news in some of these countries. Ethiopia, a company like Sunpeak Metals, just on some geopolitical weight being taken off the shoulders, their share price moved without them having to do much of anything.
Yep.
So it's still not without its risk. Everywhere's got its geopolitical risk here. But how how smooth are these waters here in this area of the world? Is it are we full sails ahead?
I'm really fascinated by this mineral belt, and as you mentioned, it extends up through Ethiopia, through Eritrea, Sudan, Egypt, across the Red Sea, into Yemen. I would say that's uninvestable at the moment, and Saudi. And part of the appeal of it is that because of the jurisdictional risk that's inherent with this region of the world, it is very largely untouched relative to other major mineral belts. So the ANS is prospective for orogenic gold, VMS, porphyry on both sides of the Red Sea. And we've seen some of the world's largest miners express significant interest. Barrick, Mark Bristow is active both in Saudi and in Egypt. Friedland through Ivanhoe Electric has been pushing chips into the table in Saudi Arabia. So I've actually taken two trips to this region in the past 12 months. Last spring, I was in Egypt visiting Elemental Altus's Och Gold subsidiary. They have some very interesting grassroots ground out there that has since gone into a private company called Into Metals, which is majority owned by Naguib Sawaris, one of Egypt's wealthiest men, if not the wealthiest in Egypt. Elemental, of course, holds a 10% equity stake, I believe, in ANS, and then also a healthy royalty over the full land package. And then most recently was in Eritrea, which is a country that I've wanted to visit for a very long time, and was able to see Alpha Exploration's Karkasha project in the western part of the country there. That's a really fascinating project geologically. They've got orogenic gold, porphyry, and VMS targets, all three of them quite credible on their large land package. So I can't off the top of my head name any other company that has, there are three different kicks at the can in this regard. Yeah. So it's a fascinating region. We have exposure through Elemental Altus and through a private company called Lotus Gold, which is also active in Egypt. Co-founder there is Hai Don from Osino, and you know he's just wrapping up a big win down in Namibia. Fingers crossed that deal does go across the finish line. I do expect it will. But I'm quite intrigued by the region, and I think it's going to be one of the hot places to go here for metal exploration over the next 5 to 10 years.
Let me ask you about valuations of these companies, though, Matt. I mean, my personal, opinion or you know, relationship with it, like I've had a number of deals come into my desk, look through presentations, companies financing either as private cos or also public. And even in 2022, 2023, when the junior market was just absolutely crushed in the public markets, it's a lot of these companies seemed completely overvalued to me. Hmm. And there was a disconnect between Arabian Nubian Shield Explorer's valuations, what they're looking to raise compared to what the rest of the public market was raising. And maybe that's not a fair assessment, but that's just kind of my take. And, you know, would you push back on that assessment at all?
Or no? I think in a couple cases, you're right. Alpha is a name that I like quite a bit. But it's helped buoyed by a very strong shareholder. His name is Brahani Sokar. I like Brahani a lot. I think he's done great work with Alpha. Very strong hands there. But you know, if he didn't own 40% of the company, perhaps the valuation would be a bit lower. Lotus Gold, which we do own, I'll agree. The most recent financing, at least at the time, seemed a little bit on the pricier side. I think that was helped by High's involvement, as well as Ross Beattie, who's a 10% shareholder. So I think as the market improves, that these companies will grow into those valuations in both cases. But if you're looking for absolute, you know, penny on the dollars opportunities, maybe this is not the right place to look. But if you're looking for, you know, tier one discovery potential with teams with access to capital and have the opportunity to knock it out of the park, there's the opportunity here. So your point is taken. But I don't think that's a reason to look away from this region more generally or at these two names specifically.
Very good. Let's throw a curveball out there and change topics here. Books. We haven't had book recommendations in so long on this podcast. In fact, I actually haven't read a mining book in quite some time.
Oh, come on, Trevor.
I haven't. I need a break from this. I need a break from this stuff every once in a while. I'm actually reading the Chip Wars book that was published last year or 2 years ago, which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I think I can create some presentations on the resource space based on that history of semiconductors. That's a story for another time. But you've got some ideas, some books that you wanted to bring up for readers to pay or listeners to pay attention to.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's the classics that I'll just throw out there from a mining perspective for those maybe new to the space. Have to read No Guts, No Glory, you know, the rise of Adolf Lundin. Have to read The Big Score, story of Robert Friedland's Voisey's Bay discovery through Diamond Fields International. Another really good one was written by Northern Miner authors. That's called Gold Today, Gone Tomorrow, about the rise and fall of Briex, which is just a classic story. Couple other ones and shout out to Dave Lotan for the recommendations here that I've read in the past year. Tales from the Prospector Club. That was a fascinating collection of short essays and pretty wild stories about the space that we frequent. And then another good one called Not for Gold Alone. So those are some names for you. I'll add two more here. I the most recent book that I read is called The Social License. The story of the San Cristobal mine. And that's by Robert Boudier and Ian Thompson. And that actually reads more like a textbook. So it's a very, very interesting read about ESG relations and how companies and communities interact, go through trials and tribulations, but in this case came out to a pretty good outcome. So I think for more serious investors, they get some really good value from that. I'm kind of thinking about social, really through the social lens. That's a focus mostly on the S. And then the other book that's related to this is called The Gift of El Tio. And I'm just flying through this. That's by Larry Buchanan and his wife, Karen Grants. And Larry Buchanan was the one who discovered San Cristobal in the mid-1990s. So this is a memoir written by him and his wife. And she actually flew out there and taught English in a local village school. So it's really interesting reading this memoir after reading the social license story of the San Cristobal Mine. So those are two that are maybe not as well known that I would throw onto the list.
Very interesting. All right, Matt, good to see you. Thanks for those recommendations. Let's try to not make it so long next time. I mean, not this episode was long, but to have you on quicker time frame than last time.
Sounds great, Trevor. Good, it was good joining you. We'll do this soon.
Yeah, thank you.
The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Mining Stock Daily and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.